network of your transistorized amplifier, that as you adjust those controls, the power output is going up and down. You think you're putting it in and out of resonance, and there's a lot more going on than that. If you're simultaneously measuring current of that transistorized final stage, you'll find that there are certain settings of the tuning and loading controls where you get a tiny bit more power output, but the current drain of the final stage is twice as high as normal, and it's going to really kill a battery in a hurry, and it's going to run hot, and it's not the desirable way of tuning it, but you're only getting a small increase in power. You'll see that characteristic of transistorized amplifiers. What I'm getting at is the current drawn by the final stage and the power output of the final stage is heavily dependent on what impedance that final stage of the transmitter is seeing. This is particularly true of solid-state stages, more than tube stages. So therefore, as you go from antenna A to antenna B, let me drop, the real power being delivered by the final stage of the transmitter is going up and down. The point of radiation in altitude is going up and down. The antenna gain is moving a little bit, and the point of reflection of the one or two sources of RF energy are going in phase and out of phase with the reflection off the floor versus the direct path. It's unfortunate that real life is so complicated. And so this relatively simple sounding question, in the real world, you're slowly being exposed to the fact that to make good antenna measurements, even in an anechoic chamber, with good laboratory test equipment, well calibrated, traceable to the bureau. Let me drop. As a couple of very smart people have said in the past, antenna measurements with repeatability and traceability are some of the most difficult measurements in the world, because in the case of testing an amplifier that's sitting on the bench, you can measure the input impedance, the output impedance, the power transfer, the gain. You're measuring an amplifier. You decide to measure an antenna. You're sort of measuring the antenna. You're measuring the characteristics of the signal generator that's feeding the antenna. And you're really lighting up the whole darn environment around the antenna. Think you're testing an antenna. You're testing an antenna plus environment, plus the variations of the source of signal that's going into the antenna as a function of impedance match and Q and bandwidth and so on. So real traceable antenna measurements ain't easy. So I didn't give you a nice direct answer. I don't think there is one without overly clouding over the issue, if you can see what I mean. At least you know some of the variables involved. KC2WGB, I'm not sure everybody's going to be happy with this one. K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Very good, Nick. No, I think that's a good answer because it is difficult. I think the only thing you can measure accurately to the Bureau standard is its length. So, okay. I'll kick it back to you, Dick, and we can go over to Paul, who's probably going to have a nice report for us. And we'll talk again next week. KC2WGB.
By the way, John, was there more than one guy that really deserves an answer tonight as far as the mailbag is concerned? Over to you, John.
That question I broached because it was put up on the chat room and I wanted to get that taken care of. The others can wait till next week, no problem.
Very fine, John. Okay. That man who puts up magic dipole antennas in Ronkonkoma that can tolerate all the things that the tree...
Dick, I think Rick had a question.
Say it again?
I think N2EO had a question.
Yeah, and so does AC2IS. I'm going to be delaying the questions until after the space report because we are running late tonight. Go right ahead, Paul. WS2N, K2RW in the second half.
Okay, very good, Dick. And this is WS2N. And by the way, those pins I was talking to you about before, belaying pins is what it is. BELAYING pins. That's what I was saying. Just a wooden piece of dowel rod, you know, you cut out a one-inch hole on a piece of 2x4, shape it out the best you can around a tree, and make your own. You know, you could buy them at, like, ridiculous prices on the internet. You can make your own.
Yeah.
So that's what I was saying before. Space Report, you've got a flight coming up, a manned space flight, at the end of the week, Friday, from Baikonur in Kazakhstan. Russians are going to send up three astronauts, and two of them are going to be staying on the ISS for a year, Scott Kelly and his Russian counterpart. Scott Kelly and his brother have been astronauts like forever, and he's been up to the ISS before, Scott, and this time he's going to be staying up there for a whole year. They want to see how things go. Test them out real good, and check out everything medically for eventual planned trips to Mars. So that's what they need to do. It's been done longer. There was one Russian who's got over 400 days on the Mir space station. But they're going to do this, and they'll probably do it a couple more times with different astronauts and cosmonauts. So, interesting flight. And we'll see how he does. Definitely ought to mention that. That's coming up time 2:30 Eastern Standard Time on Friday the 27th. Okay, I want to talk about another cargo ship that's being developed by Lockheed. There's a number of them that go up there now. We have the Progress, of course, by the Russians. The H-2 by Japan, that goes up about once a year. Of course, now you have the American Dragon by SpaceX. That's been going up there. In fact, you've got the sixth one going up, probably the April 10th. And we did have Cygnus going up there for by Orbital. But Orbital had the explosion there the end of last year. And they're working on a way to continue their contract. You know, these are over $1 billion contracts with NASA. They had a contract for 8 flights. SpaceX had a contract for 12. So to make good on Orbital, the Cygnus spacecraft, they're going to launch that on. They made a deal with Boeing. They're going to launch that on a United Line, ULA, United Launch Alliance Atlas rocket. They'll probably do that before the end of the year. Maybe as early as January, probably next year. And maybe one of them. Well, and then they plan on going back to Antares rocket, you know, the one that blew up with different, completely different engines. We drop it WS2F. Up all those cargo missions, because now Lockheed is going to put a bid in, you know, these contracts that were out there now by SpaceX and Orbital are going to be up in 2017. So there's new bids that are coming out. Same people will probably bid on future cargo flights. But Lockheed is also now going to get into the mix. They have a spacecraft called Jupiter, and they're going to put that on the top of an Atlas rocket and put that to space. If they, you know, if they get the contract, even if they don't get the contract, they plan on this anyway. So they basically want it. This is the tugboat of the group. The other one is called Exoliner. Exoliner will be the trailer part of a tractor trailer. That'll be sent up also on an Atlas rocket. But that really don't have any maneuvering jets or brains on it or anything. It's just going to be a cargo vessel. carried up by the third stage of the Atlas rocket, and then it'll be put into orbit. As it's in orbit, this Jupiter spacecraft that Lockheed has already sent up will come over with a robotic arm attached to it and separate it from the third stage of the Atlas rocket and attach it to itself. But before doing that, it would disconnect an existing, another XL-1 that it already picked up from the space station. So it's going to be an ongoing version. It would take that one that was already unloaded to the space station, take that XL-1 and attach it to the Atlas third stage. Yeah, it was third stage would retrofire its rockets, and it would deorbit and burn up. And this would go on and on. The Jupiter tug would pull the have the attached XL-1 that came up on the Atlas and attach that to the International Space Station. And it would go on like that. Months would go by, another XL-1 would be sent up. The one that was now attached to the ISS would be separated by Jupiter, and that would go back to the location where the new XL-1 is, and it would disconnect that and reconnect the other one, and back and forth it goes. They think it would save money. Because all the brains and the retro rockets and the fuel and everything would be on Jupiter. Where's all this fuel going to come from to keep this spacecraft in orbit indefinitely? Every one of the flights of the Atlas that came up with an XL-1, it would have a fuel tank, and that would attach to the Jupiter. And then they would have now more fuel to stay in orbit. So that's their plan. They plan on putting a bid out to NASA, and then you'll have a whole bunch of people involved. Different companies, Lockheed now, of course, and Boeing now has the CST-100 that they plan on using as a manned transport. They plan on transporting, pulling up to 7 people on board. That will be, they've already got the contract with NASA to do that. They're going to take a cargo version of the CST-100 and create that and put a bid into NASA to resupply the space station with that. So you'll have Boeing, you'll have Lockheed, you'll still have SpaceX, and you'll also have Orbital Science with the Cygnus. And one more is now getting back into the ring. And you can really see why this is now a corporate space race. The new one is Sierra Nevada. They're the ones that lost the astronaut taxi bid for their Dream Chaser. They had plans on putting up the 7 astronauts on board that and going back and forth to the space station. But they lost out to SpaceX and Boeing on the last deal last year. But they still plan on making a smaller version, manned version of that. But now they want to also make a cargo version of that spacecraft. Originally that was supposed to sit on top of an Atlas spacecraft, an Atlas rocket, with the wings open and all, and just on top with no bearing and blast out into space. But now they plan on doing the same thing, putting it on top of an Atlas, but with a fairing around it, and then the wings in the back will fold in to fit within inside a 4-meter fairing. So that's their plan. It would be a cargo version, no windows, no people, and that would attach to the space station. And the difference is that would be able to break science equipment back to Earth, because that would land on any runway. So, Dick, that's the main main things I wanted to discuss. There's other things that are going up, planned missions now for a solar mission. They're planned, they're 3 years down the road from now, called the Solar Probe Plus mission. That's a spacecraft that's going to be developed to be sent to the sun to investigate the sun. It's going to come very close to the sun on a regular basis. Plans are going less than 4 million miles from the sun. So they need a heavy lift, very heavy lift vehicle to do that. Falcon 9's heavy lift vehicle won't be ready by that time. So they plan on using the Delta IV Heavy. Same setup that launched the Orion test vehicle a few months ago to 3,600 feet in space. So that should be an interesting mission. It'll orbit the sun about 25 to 27 times over its first primary mission. Maybe get extended missions after that. Sounds like a very interesting planned mission by NASA. Yeah, I guess if they can get it completely funded, it looks like it's funded. All they need to do is put the ribbons on and I guess have somebody sign it. I don't know how much further you want to go into this, Dick, but there's plenty of other things on the drawing board as well, including ion engines to push another new spacecraft into orbit around Mars. You know, the ones that are in orbit around Mars have been around there, going around and around for years now. They're getting a little tired and they're worried about some failings, and they need a new communication spacecraft. There's a plan on doing that as well for 2020. And they're going to utilize ion engines. Seems like everybody's being very successful now with ion engines. Lower cost, better reliability, and we could always talk about that in the future as well. So that's pretty much it, Dick, for the space report. Let me drop it. Any comments, questions, you could always email me at spacenetreport@gmail.com. Dick, over to you for questions, comments, or what have you. That's about all I have for this week. K2RIW, WS2N.
Very good, Paul. Does anybody have any further questions for Paul before I open up the subject of this very pivotal, exciting-sounding article in Wednesday's issue of Newsday? Wednesday, May 18th, a very striking article. Anybody got any further questions on what Paul has said so far? Give me a call, that is right now, K2RIW and the Tech Man. Okay, there being none, for those who subscribe to Newsday, do get a hold if you're interested in space. An exciting sounding project, very blue sky by my standards. The Dutch non-profit organization, and it's called, let's see now, Mr. Bas Landstrop, former research scientist, and Arnold Welders of the Netherlands have established this thing called the Mars One Project, I think is what it's called. Anyhow, what the say again, John? I say again, Paul?
You had the name right.
Okay, now, they had, in other words, this is a mission that's going to be one way. They're going to send 6 spacecraft to Mars with 4 people on each spacecraft, a total of 24 human beings, one-way trip to Mars and to stay there forever and live there, till the soil, do whatever is required to manufacture air and water, and live there for the rest of their lives. One-way trip. That is the proposal of this Dutch company, this Dutch non-profit organization. Would you believe they received volunteers, 202,586 people said, I want to go. 202,000 people. In other words, a little bit shy of a quarter of a million people volunteered. Through three or four steps of whittling them down, they've now whittled it down to 100 human beings. They're eventually going to whittle it down to 24. But of those 100 human beings that are still candidates after this whittling down process, the most exciting one is Laura Kay of Kings Park. She's the only one from New York State. Let me drop it. Laurel Kay, L-A-U-R-E-L, first name and second name Kay, K-A-Y-E of Kings Park. Laurel Kay has been selected, and Laurel Kay is no ordinary student. She's a senior at Duke University. She's done some work at Oxford, and she received a telescope from her father for Christmas when she was 12, and she's been heavily involved in her desire to be involved in space all of her life so far. She's 20 years of age. So for the last 8 years, she's been thinking of nothing but space. And so she and the 99 other candidates are eventually going to be whittled down to a total of 24. And in this picture in Newsday, they show you what the proposed view of the six spacecraft landing on Mars, what they're going to look like, their habitat, so to speak. Let me drop. So can you imagine volunteering? They need some further funding. It's right now privately funded. The major step they think is going to be done for $6 billion. That's an amazing number to me. NASA invested something in the vicinity of $31 billion in the Apollo program to go to the moon. From a technological point of view, you could say that going to Mars is either 100 times or 1,000 times more difficult. And they're proposing to do it for $6 billion. That strikes me as a very low number. But to go there one way, to be a pioneer, I mean, to watch our astronauts doing a so-called spacewalk, when they're doing service on the International Space Station, in the old days from the space shuttle, or nowadays with other craft that get them up there, like Soyuz. Let me drop. You watch a news report, or if you happen to have a NASA Select satellite television receiving system, so that hours on end you can watch an astronaut doing a spacecraft, doing an extravehicular activity out in hard vacuum of space around the International Space Station. It looks exciting. What you see looks very desirable. What really goes into it, climb into that spacesuit after acclimating yourself for the previous 12 hours in a pure oxygen atmosphere at low air pressure in order to get rid of all the nitrogen in your joints, because in the spacesuit you're going to be running at one-third or one-quarter. What's the actual pounds per square inch that our spacesuits run at, Paul? You know that better than I do. WS2N, K2LAW.
Pure oxygen. They're down to 3 now. Back in White's day, they used to be around 5 at White's, you know, when first spacewalks. So it's probably 3 or 4 pounds. Pure oxygen. Pure oxygen, I think.
So instead of 14.7 pounds per square inch, normal sea level air pressure, they're running something like 3 or 4 pounds per square inch in a spacesuit, which is, I'm going to say, is the equivalent of being on the top of Mount Everest, I think. And on the top of Mount Everest, if you're not breathing oxygen, you're getting all kinds of brain damage from hypoxia. So you're breathing pure oxygen at very low pressure in a spacesuit. The spacesuit runs at very low pressure because if you ran at full pressure, the slightest leak would leak the air out very fast. The pressure on the joints change volume. I'm talking about the joints at your elbow, your knee, and places like that. The bendable section of the spacesuit, when it bends, it changes volume, so that any change in volume when it's working against the air pressure on the inside gives you resistance. So you talk to an astronaut who's been in the spacesuit, like Story Musgrave, a few years ago. He made a presentation for the Astronomical Society of Long Island. Let me drop it.
And your hands are the worst. That really is hot. Your hands.
enough so that you can feel the products you're touching. But his fingers became so frozen at low temperatures in space during the time that the spacewalk, which when he was doing that repair of the Hubble Space Telescope, he spent 45 minutes on the backside of the Earth and 45 minutes on the front side. During the 45 minutes on the backside, he's exposed to the 3-degree Kelvin, very low temperature of space. What little bit of heat on the other side of him is coming from the Earth that's 220 miles below him. He's getting a little bit of radiation heat from the Earth, maybe a little bit of radiation heat from the space shuttle that he's alongside of while doing this repair. His fingers became so frozen that I believe he came close to getting, what do they call that now? I can't even think of the name of the condition you get when your fingers, when a portion of your body becomes frozen. What's the name for that, Paul? What was that again, John? So we're in frostbite. Because of the frostbite, he no longer has fingers, he no longer has any feeling in his hands. He made one hell of a dedication to do that repair mission. He extended to the absolute limit the time at which the space pack would keep him alive. He was out there for way beyond the normal length of time he's supposed to be using the spacesuit. His fingers are freezing. He's doing this very carefully correlated, you know what I mean? Correlated, that's not the right word. What's the word?
Graft.
That's the word I'm looking for, a choreographed procedure. Heavily practiced for years ahead of time as to exactly what hand he moves at what time to move what tool in order to squeeze it all in, all into that repair operation. It was supposed to be two separate missions, and he squeezed it all into one mission to get the Hubble back on the air, so to speak. And the total exposure he had to space environment and the radiation exposure, because the Hubble flies at a high enough altitude here at the lower edge of the Van Allen belt, so he's being irradiated. He's got a lifetime exposure during this procedure. Let me drop this. So before you get into that spacesuit, you make sure the batteries are fully charged. You make sure that the sources of water and oxygen are fully charged. You check out the suit to make sure that the zillions of joints are not leaking and everything is working correctly. All the electronics is working. The human being has to prepare for hours ahead of time. What's the length of time that you have to be breathing pure oxygen at low pressure in order to get all the nitrogen out of your body before you even climb into the suit? Do you happen to know that length of time? You prepare the human being before you put him in the suit, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
That's for years now. They were doing a camp out in the Quest. Quest Lab is the Quest module is where they do your, you know, EVAs for the American side. And they would do a camp out. They put the two guys in there, and they close the door behind them. That's where they would stay all night long. That would help purge the yard. It would lower the nitrogen and start breathing, you know, a lot more oxygen. Now it looks like what they do is they, you know, a couple hours before they sit there with the mask on and they're breathing oxygen that way. I don't think they do the camp out things anymore. But, that's what I saw the last couple of flights. But then, you know, for many hours, they're getting that nitrogen out of their system before they actually don the suits.
At standard temperature and pressure at the surface of the Earth, you're getting 14.7 pounds per square inch of air pressure. 20 or 21% of that air is oxygen. And so it's essentially, what, one-fifth? One-fifth of the air is oxygen. If you cut down the pressure to one-fifth pressure and make it pure oxygen, the body is getting essentially the same amount of oxygen. And if they're now doing this mask wearing at the pressure of the International Space Station, do you know the pressure that the International Space Station runs at, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Same as here, 14.7. And they did the same thing on here, 14.7. So that's it. And now they also run the nitrogen. It would never run pure oxygen up there. They don't want another Apollo 1 fire, that's for sure. So all the space stations have 14.7. Thank you.
So the space station is running at 14.7, 21% oxygen, and the rest nitrogen. in order to simulate, to simulate the real atmosphere of the surface of the Earth. But now here's an astronaut with a mask on, breathing pure oxygen. And that pure oxygen is almost five times more oxygen density than he would normally get at normal conditions. He's doing that to purge the nitrogen out of his body. But there are certain disadvantages of breathing pure oxygen for a length of time. The body chemistry is not really set up for that. Do you know of any of the disadvantages of doing that, Paul? WS2N? I think there's got to be. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Know of any disadvantage of it. I mean, you don't want the bend, so, you know, you've got to go through this whole process. You know, that's all I've heard about. I don't think there's any other side effects involved with what, you know, doing these spacewalk.
Yeah, John recognized, I didn't say there's a disadvantage of doing the spacewalk, but if you breathe pure oxygen at normal air pressure, I know that if you do that to a newborn child, you give them pure oxygen in an incubator, there's a high probability you're going to create blindness. So there are definite side effects.
That in the early flight sticker.
Okay.
What happened there?
Let's see what John's got to say about this. KC2WGB, K2LIW. Go ahead, John.
Dick, exactly what you mentioned. I knew there was a vision problem on long endurance. Yeah, you already mentioned it.
The body is not designed for pure oxygen at normal pressure. So even though you're doing it for a brief period of time to purge the nitrogen out of your system so you don't get the bends, then climb into the spacesuit and operate at 3 or 4 pounds per square inch instead of 14.7. And you've got to do that, otherwise you won't be able to bend the joints of the suit. So as you can see, there's a huge procedure required to put a human being into a spacesuit. Lots of hours of preparation ahead of time for the human being, lots of preparation for hours ahead of time to make sure that a zillion circuits in that spacesuit, oxygen, battery power, joint integrity, and everything else has got to be just right. And just to give you an example of something that happened recently, in one of the most recent spacewalks on the International Space Station, an astronaut who was out there for 6, 7, 8 hours, you've got to be drinking water and eating food for that period of time. One of the candy bars the female astronaut was eating happened to be a red dye in the candy bar, and in the weightlessness, a piece of the candy bar didn't end up in her mouth. It started drifting around in the spacesuit. And to make a long story short, it drifted all the way down one of her arms, down to the hand, and it got smeared into the glove in the hand. When she came back in after the EVA, and they took the suit off of her, when they removed the glove, her hand was bright red, and everybody got shocked. They thought her hand was bleeding continuously, you know, from all... Yeah, go ahead, give me some of the details on that one, Paul. Until they discovered that it was the candy bar that had gotten smeared on her hand that made it red, they thought her whole hand was bleeding, and it really shocked the daylights out of people. Over to you on this one, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
No, I didn't jump in on that one. Before I did, I was trying to tell you about the Apollo 1. They ran pressure. They wanted to pressure test the Apollo 1. And they were on the ground. They weren't much. They were sitting on a, you know, attached to the, you know, inside the spacecraft, you know, in Florida. And they had 14.7 pounds on the outside, so they wanted to duplicate 5 pounds of pressure on the inside of the spacecraft. So they pumped that up, so now you had, you know, almost 20 pounds of PSI oxygen inside the spacecraft. And that's what really did it, the extra pressure of pure oxygen. It will be an instant fire if one thing gets a little hot. But they thought they could do this. They did it before, and now they realize no more of that. So that's the reason the space station and Mir was at 14.7 with nitrogen and oxygen. So, that's what I was talking about, not the woman with the candy bar.
Yeah, during that practice on the launch pad where the fire killed three astronauts, and I used to know their names. I would recognize their names. Do you remember the names of those astronauts that got killed in that fire up home?
Gus Grissom, Chaffee, and Ed White. Ed White was the first American to do a spacewalk. Gus Grissom, of course, he went up before. And Chaffee, that would have been his first flight. Thanks.
If you've ever done an experiment where you burn a fire, anything that's flammable, in pure oxygen, it burns at a fierce rate. So I think the prediction was that, the assessment was that a socket wrench had been left under one of the couches that the astronauts were sleeping on, so to speak, and it created a spark in some of the wiring. Ordinary wiring that would be, under normal circumstances, essentially non-flammable in that pure oxygen atmosphere of extended pressure became a flammable substance real fast. And so the pressure inside the spacecraft built up probably in seconds to being a huge number. And in those days, you couldn't blow the hatch. You had to disconnect bolts to open up the hatch. And the astronauts started disconnecting those bolts, but didn't get very far. I think that was where they discovered they got to have a pyrotechnic that can blow the hatch in a hurry. Give me a couple of words on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yes, that's correct. And, they eventually designed the system where you would turn one lever, and that would pull, a whole series of dogged latches out. But before that, you got involved with this whole bolt setup. Ed White was the tallest of the three, and they had him in the middle. He was in the middle, and he was able to, actually reach the bolts, but he couldn't get to do anything quick enough. But they know he was reaching for it. And it's never been confirmed about the fire, but that's the best scenario that they've come up with, what you mentioned with the socket wrench and the wires shorting out on the seat. Some seat there.
Who we have, Dick? You got some further information on this one, Rich? Into EO, K2RIW?
Give you a little information. I'm a diabetic, and I have a cut that won't heal on the heel of my foot. And I'm going to be going to Plainview Hospital for what they call a hyperbaric chamber. That's where they bring you up 2.5 atmospheres for 90 minutes in a hyperbaric chamber. And what that does is healing to be accelerated. I don't even know if they know why. But they told me I have to watch a video first. Got to be very careful, and they have to do some tests on my heart and other things to make sure I'm a candidate. They think I am a candidate. And they said to me that I can't wear any clothes. They're going to give me a gown to put on, because anything like cotton or anything can create a spark and kill me. So that's just sort of akin to it, Dick. Over.
So as you can tell, I'm giving you guys some of the details of an astronaut preparing himself, preparing the suit, climbing into the spacesuit, and doing a spacewalk for 6, 7, or at most 8 hours. During those 8 hours, he has to be consuming water, he's got to be consuming food, and his body has to be dumping waste products. In order to do that, he's essentially wearing the equivalent of a highly absorbent large diaper. And so each time a astronaut, cosmonaut, space scientist on Mars wants to go out of their habitat in order to do all of this outside labor that's required to till the soil, to do all the things that are required to find water, find oxygen, find air, create water, and grow food. All of that's got to be done from a spacesuit. And the rigmarole of living in a spacesuit is far from desirable. You can't do that day in and day out because you're going to get diaper rash, among other problems. Let me drop. Okay. So as I see it, this one-way mission to Mars for 24 people that's supposed to take place in the year 2024. The main thing you can get out of this is the fact that 202,586 people volunteered for this one-way mission. Without a doubt, our youth are definitely interested in what the astronauts do, interested in space, and now they think that the moon is kind of old hat. They think Mars is the next jump. And the details of providing food, oxygen, and whatever, I mean, it's going to take a year just to get to Mars. And as you've heard me say before, let me drop. EPC, you want to say something on this one, Hal? Go ahead.
Yes.
Hal, we've turned it over to you, but we don't hear anything. What I'm getting at is living on Mars, on paper, sounds very desirable. Sounds like it's very frontier, very exciting, high technology science work, it sounds like. You get into the details of the fact that in 1 year, you don't realize that you consume an amount of oxygen, an amount of food, an amount of water, that if I pack it as tight as I can into one spot, it has approximately the volume of your house, and it has approximately the weight of your house. That's what the raw materials are required to keep you alive for 1 year. So four astronauts in this tiny little spacecraft for a year on the way to Mars, and then living on Mars, one way and never coming home. You can tell I don't believe. I'm enthusiastic about the fact that our youth are thinking about space, and Mars they think is the next major goal. Can we drop? So they've got a positive attitude, but when you get into the details of actually living there in a spacesuit, you don't wanna, when you look at these little habitats they're going to be in, it's something about twice the size of an Apollo command module, maybe three times the size of Apollo command module. That's a little bit better than living in a phone booth, if you know what I mean. One person in a phone booth, a little bit better than that. Not a hell of a lot. To sit inside that cramped compartment day in and day out with four people, that ain't going to be pleasant. And in order to do all the work to till the soil, and by the way, the air pressure on Mars is like, I think it's 0.1, I think, is it 1%? It's around 0.1% of air pressure we've got here on Earth. It's got no magnetic field. It's got no Van Allen, if you know what I mean. All of these things that are going to be putting you at risk, all of the protection you have under this atmosphere, under this Van Allen belt, and under this magnetic field of the Earth. Let me drop. All of that goes away. This is an extremely severe environment. And unless somebody makes a huge breakthrough in the design of spacesuits that give you higher pressure, more maneuverability, more life, and the equivalent of a bathroom, and until a spacesuit comes a long way. I mean, here we are 30 years, 40 years downrange in the space program, and they've been continuously developing spacesuits, and it's risen to a very high technology. But still, with that very high technology, I've given you guys some of the details. You listen to Story Musgrave describe what it was like living in that spacesuit for 8 hours while doing this very complicated maneuver to repair the Hubble Space Telescope. And so it takes a very dedicated, highly trained human being to do that, very healthy human being to do that. And 202,000 people have volunteered for a one-way mission. Wow. Exciting-looking pictures, a good-looking lady. I'm talking about Laura K. What's her name? Laurel K. K-A-Y-E. A brilliant student at Duke University who did some of her education at Oxford. I mean, she's a... when it comes to choosing a candidate, you probably can't get a better candidate in health, age, enthusiasm, education, and whatever. She's a fantastic candidate. But what is she really going to be able to do on Mars that can't be done with unmanned space vehicles? I mean, that's an interesting question to ask, and there's no good answer for it. Let me drop. As you can tell, I don't believe this is going to take place. I'm having trouble believing they're going to get enough funding and be able to, in the next 9 years, 2024 they think they're going to do it. Well, let's make it 10 years. In 10 years, are they going to get the funding, the research, and get rid of all of these details that I'm talking to you about? That's a very tall order. And is it ethical to send 24 highly qualified human beings on a one-way mission where my rough guess of survivability ain't good? To get there alive, to land without errors, and to survive on that surface and never come back home under that environment of that very high radiation dosage, I don't know the answer, but maybe the answer is life expectancy there is going to be 20 years. To take a 78-year life expectancy and cut it down to a 20-year person living another 20 years, 40 years total, in that tough environment, and what are you getting in return for that investment in dollars, human beings, and whatever? Whenever you stretch your capability as a nation, as we did on the Apollo program, without a doubt, we made huge advancements in rocketry, computers, computer programs, ceramic materials, material development, medical development. Lots of good things happened on the Apollo program, without a doubt. And so when you put a whole nation, when a whole nation puts their shoulder to the wheel to, in our particular case, we had to beat the Russians, so to speak. We were in the middle of this huge Cold War. And so although they beat us to space and they beat us to the first spacewalk, we eventually beat them to the moon, just barely. And national pride was involved. Well, this doesn't quite fall into that category. Of the people who are listening to me right now, how many of you guys would volunteer for a one-way trip to Mars and never come back home? How many of you guys would volunteer for that? KQRIW is listening.
Dick, can you volunteer other people? KC2RFN.
Hey, Alan, who would you volunteer? Oh, yes, I got a guess as to somebody. Are you allowed to tell us who you would volunteer for that, Alan?
Unfortunately, that's classified information, Dick.
Okay. Even if you volunteer the person, he still has to be willing to go, unless you're going to chain him down and blast him off. This is without a doubt a very blue sky project. It is a really shooting for the stars. I mean, it's a goal that's way out there, way up there. Dollars, technology, human sacrifice, risk, all the things you can add up. I just offered you guys an opportunity to say, yes, I would volunteer, and I don't think anybody volunteered. Maybe it's because I made it sound so desirable. Hey, Alan, give me your impression. I wonder if you've seen this article in Newsday. A very good-looking lady. If I was single, I would pursue her. But I would probably try to talk her out of this operation. You got any first impressions on this, depending on how much of what I just said about this last 15 minutes you heard, Alan? KC2RFN, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, the thing that came to mind was grotesque. I think it's disgusting to send anybody on a one-way mission, especially for no real ends. At 20-year-olds, they're still just kids. You know, they're not fully formed. They're still living somewhat in fantasy land. And that might actually go double for the extremely brilliant ones, because I know some. And a lot of them never really grow up. And these are the kind of people that they're going for. And sending a 20-year-old out to his or her death, I think, is disgusting.
Dick, what do you think WS1 this project will ever get off the ground? I'm serious.
I double with Barry. I also have a comment, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to go to Barry and Paul in that order. Barry, you're one of the furthest thinking guys I know. If you could be assured of 90% probability of survival and the possibility of going to Mars, and maybe 20 years later they'll discover a way to bring you back home, would you volunteer for this, Barry? And to moon bounce, K2RIW, and to Mars bounce, and to Mars. northbound, K2RW, you got it, Barry.
I think what the answer to that is, they don't have a guarantee of return. I want 100% guarantee of return. Then there's about a 50% chance that I take the mission.
Now, either you or Ellen are talking about people that are very young kids, and in my mind, I'm still a kid. I climb radio towers. I think of fairly big projects in my backyard. So to some degree, I'm a kid. But I'm not going to volunteer for this one. Maybe Paul would, though I somehow doubt it. He's a little more conservative than I am. WS2N, K2RAW, you got a Paul.
Need all the nations of the world behind me, and that's pretty much what it's going to take. You're going to see a 16-country group behind the next Mars mission, similar to what's going on with the International Space Station. You're going to see a bunch of countries involved. You know, already you have European Space Agency involved with building the service module for the Orion system, and they, of course, plan on using Orion to go to Mars. But this group here that you're talking about, Mars One, yeah, they came out a couple of years ago, and we could have our opinions on ham radio. The whole thing is a scam, as far as I'm concerned. And in fact, the Chinese government's all there. Don't answer this.
This project will ever get to the ground
to apply to this. And this guy doesn't have two nickels to rub together. He's got this whole thing going, and he thinks he's going to get somebody like SpaceX, a respectable company, to blast these people to their death. I don't think so. Even Elon Musk, they asked him about the setup that went to Mars with Curiosity with these this overhead pack, jet pack, that, you know, complicated thing with cables going down. And they asked him what he thought about that. Would you go on a system like that if they were going to land you on Mars like that? He said, time it out. He said, I want to go to Mars. I don't want to die there. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
I have in front of me a book, a very well-written book by Mary Roach, R-O-A-C-H, entitled Packing for Mars. And she gives you some of the inside information. I think this is a 2010 book, if I remember correctly, when it was published. Very well-done book. She gives you, 2010. That's when I bought it. She gives you a lot of inside information about what really goes on in NASA. One of the things I can tell you, for instance, is that of all the astronauts that just go into orbit on the space station or with the space shuttle, whether it's the first mission or the 15th mission, roughly 50% of them spend the first 24 hours throwing up. And you can't predict which ones. I mean, a guy may have had two missions where he was perfectly all right, and on the third mission, he's going to throw up for 24 hours or 12 hours. The body acts that way. So weightlessness is something that's significant to get used to. And some of these details of what really goes on with what the astronauts have to endure in training, and what they endure in space, and particularly what they endure inside of a spacesuit, is such that it's not so desirable sounding. When you watch the movies of a spacewalk, it looks very desirable. And by the way, some of you guys are saying that this is a farce. I think these people are sincere. I don't think this is a scam. I think these people really believe in what they are seeking. Let me drop. However, audio is coming out of somewhere in my shack. I can't figure out where right now. What I'm getting at is they don't know the details. Until you read the right book, until you talk to the right person, until you talk to a person who really works at the Kennedy Space Center or the Houston Space Center or the, I can't even think of the one in Maryland right now, but until you talk to people who are on the inside, it's very easy to come up with a over-glamified picture as to what astronaut life and training is like and what are the risks involved. And so I think these people are naive. But that's my impression. I don't think this is going to take place. Barry is asking, can it ever take place? I think you're sort of asking, Barry, will we have the technology to bring us to Mars with human beings? Not unmanned space probes, with human beings in, say, the year 2050. I'm skeptical. Just that pure requirement of mass and volume of the resources required to keep you alive. A human being that's alive, let me drop. Every human being that's alive is metabolizing food, oxygen and food and water, at the rate that you are generating 130 watts of heat, 24/7, if you're alive. When you're down to basic metabolism, basal metabolism, maybe you go down to 110 watts. And if you're running a marathon, maybe you're up to 300 watts or 400 watts. But somewhere around 130 watts of heat is continuously coming out of your body if you're alive. To run that heart and lung and all those other organs, and all that digestive system and that brain and everything else, to feed all of that, 130 watts of continuous energy has to be supplied to keep that human being alive. And as soon as the human being stops breathing and that body starts cooling down from 97.6 to 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, the rate at which it cools down is pretty well known, and you measure the temperature and you know the rate of cooling and you figure out exactly how long ago the person died. How long ago did he stop metabolizing? In other words, how long ago did he stop producing 130 watts of heat? So the basic requirements for keeping a person alive is very difficult to establish in space. All of those, every single one of those molecules of air, fluid, and solids that comes out of a human being, this Earth, over the next 100 years, will recycle that for you automatically. To do that recycling in space, it rolls off the tongue very easily. To really do it is extremely difficult in a short period of time in a confined environment. You can't possibly bring enough food, water, and air to sustain you for a year on the trip to Mars. And then where's it all going to come from to sustain you while you're there until you establish ways of finding it locally? And to find it locally, you need a lot of mobility. And without that spacesuit, you don't have mobility. You can see the details that are bothering the daylight.
Repeater, time out.
You can see the details that are bothering the daylights out of me. I don't think this is intentionally a farce. I don't think this is intentionally a scam. I think these people are sincere. But I think they're very naive. Unfortunately, any method by which I could bring them into less naivete is going to make them hate me. Or they're going to say I'm crazy and I got to be wrong. I'm open to comments on all of the above. Give me a call, it's KTRLIW in the TechNet.
Glenn, Dick, I think the people that are signing up to go are sincere, but not the guy who's in charge of the band. You got to be kidding. He has nothing. He has no landing spacecraft. He has no launching spacecraft to get there. He doesn't have a spacesuit. He's got nothing.
Well, NASA is a nice enough group of people that everything they develop becomes public domain. You go to the NASA Select site, you go to monthly or weekly journals that come out of NASA, and I'm on the distribution of those. I mean, they're developing all kinds of good things and giving it away free of charge. So if you had an organization that had most of the resources and you needed a spacesuit, at least the design of the spacesuit, all the details would be given to you by NASA by simply requesting it. Would they really give you a $4 million spacesuit? No. Would they give you the details for the design so that you could build one? Absolutely. So anything that we currently have that NASA has, you can get it from them as far as the details and the design. So that's not a gating item. But you need a lot more than that. NASA, how often does NASA say that we're building a spacecraft for this, this, and this mission, and eventually to Mars? They sort of say that as an afterthought. But do they really believe it, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW. And by the way, they're saying that because the youth wants to hear that. And that's where some of their backing is coming from. The youth being